Saturdays from 9 to 1. And University of Minnesota Extension presents Fridays with a Forester. It's an online series each Friday at 9 a.m. That's going through the end of April. These informal sessions will feature a different topic each week. To learn more and to register, visit z.umn.edu/Fridays2025. And the Minnesota Discovery Center in Chisholm hosts Fossils, Fossils, Fossils. Saturday, March 29 from 11 to 4, explore real fossils from the Iron Range and enjoy some dino snacks. And the Reclaiming and Advancing Leech Lake Youth Coalition is holding an interactive conversation called Changing the Narrative on Mental Health and Suicide. That is coming up Monday, March 31st, 6 p.m. at the Walker Hackensack Akeley School. Conversation will also be held Thursday, April 3rd, 6 p.m. at the Onagum Community Center. You can find more information and register. Visit the community education page on the Walker Hackensack Akeley School District's website. Time now for a special edition of the Up North Report.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with a special edition of the Up North Report. The sheriff's offices in Itasca and Cass counties are the first two Minnesota law enforcement agencies to sign on as force multipliers with ICE. Under federal law, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement may delegate authority to state and local officers to interrogate people about their immigration status during routine police work. In an executive order signed on his first day back in office, President Donald Trump required ICE to authorize local agencies to perform these duties, reopening the abandoned 287G program. Itasca County Sheriff Joe Dasovich and Cass County Sheriff Brian Welk both agreed to participate in the task force model, one of three models of cooperation in which local authorities can assist in enforcing civil immigration laws. ICE trains and deputizes selected officers within participating agencies. Historically, local agency enforcement has led to concerns of racial profiling and exposed counties and states to legal liability over constitutional rights violations. The program was shuttered in 2012 by the Obama administration, but President Trump's focus on mass deportations has led to its renewal. In interviews with KAXE, Dasovich and Welk both say they believe joining the task force model will increase safety in the communities they serve. Dasovich pointed to a recent grandparent scam in the region where at least three victims handed over about $50,000 to an in-person scammer under the belief a grandchild needed money for bail. One of the men arrested allegedly told authorities he was from Colombia and expressed concerns about being deported. Dasovich says his office is limited by how much they can assist in such a case without an agreement with ICE.
My number one priority is to keep our community safe. So I made the choice to become a TFO agency.
Welk says similar scams have occurred in Cass County and that the sheriff's office wants to be good partners with all federal law enforcement agencies.
I want our officers to be able to be fully compliant and not get caught up in any of the pitfalls that might be.
Both sheriffs acknowledge that despite this recent example, encountering undocumented immigrants in their counties through the course of police work is rare. They emphasize their agencies would not proactively look for undocumented people, limiting their involvement with ICE to people otherwise under investigation for committing crimes.
I want to be clear. This isn't just to go round up any illegal alien. This is to protect our county from a specific criminal element.
Welk similarly says his agency would not conduct raids. While local law enforcement has the authority to make arrests, they cannot detain someone unless they've met certain criteria, such as being deemed a public safety or national security threat, those with an outstanding arrest warrant, or those who've previously been deported. The complexity of immigration law, a lack of in-depth training, and infrequent enforcement are some of the factors that make the program problematic, according to Ben Casper, staff attorney with American Civil Liberties Union Minnesota.
Training just doesn't provide local law enforcement participants the level of knowledge and expertise to make reliable judgments about the status of people they're encountering.
Casper says these agreements are often decided without public input and may lead to substantial financial or moral costs, like family separation. ICE training for local agencies has not taken place, and Welk says he isn't yet sure when it will. Neither sheriff anticipates additional costs to their departments by participating. Asked about profiling risks, this is what Welk had to say.
We have policies for that, right? That's not what we're looking for. That's not our main job. This is something that if it comes up, that we're able to deal with it.
Dasovich says undocumented people might already be less likely to call 911, no matter the task force model.
Just because they're here undocumented doesn't mean they can't be a victim of a crime as well. And we would deal with the situation at hand.
More on this story at our website, KAXE.org. That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
You can hear the latest edition of the Up North Report tonight at 5:30 during All Things Considered here on KAXE. You can also find more local stories at KAXE.org. 6 minutes after 7 o'clock, I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Monday morning show. Up ahead, we'll have more news from National Public Radio, and then we'll have events up north. Chris Walker and I will take a closer look at the many events happening throughout the region this week. Support comes from Timber Lake Lodge in Grand Rapids and offering an endless soup and salad bar for lunch, burgers and hand-cut steaks for dinner. More at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. Northern Community Radio's Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of every month. If you have questions or are interested in joining the board, you can contact us 218-326-1234 during business hours. The board's full meeting schedule is online at KAXE.org. There's more ahead from Morning Edition from National Public Radio.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Leila Faudel in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Coming up, I speak with the wife of Columbia graduate student Mahmoud Khalil, a target of the Trump administration's deportation push. But first...
At least three dozen people are dead after severe weather sparked tornadoes, dust storms, wildfires, and heavy rainfall across the South and Midwest over the weekend.
The storms continue to rattle the East Coast overnight, but have largely moved offshore. Residents across the country are still taking stock of the damage.
NPR's Ryland Barton has been following this, so tell us what happened over the weekend.
Yeah, so this really volatile storm system affected a huge swath of the country. It created a trail of destruction from Kansas and Oklahoma down to Texas, and then over east to Missouri, Arkansas, and Mississippi. In the east side, on Friday and Saturday, the system dropped baseball-sized hail in some places, produced dozens of deadly tornadoes. Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves said that six people were killed in tornadoes there. Speaking on Sunday, he promised a quick response.
Mississippians in times like these step up and do what is necessary to take care of our friends and our neighbors, and that makes me proud to be a Mississippian.
Also, 12 people died in Missouri, where Governor Mike Cahoe said yesterday that hundreds of homes, schools, and businesses were destroyed or severely damaged. In Arkansas, the National Weather Service says that damage from two of the tornadoes there showed they were likely F4s. That's the second strongest class of tornadoes, with one of them estimated to have a peak wind of 170 miles an hour. The last time that happened on the same day in the state was 1997. First responders across the region are still working to clear debris, restore power to homes, and eventually distribute supplies for recovery.
Yeah, now tell us about the high wind and wildfires that took place on the western side of the area affected by the storm.
Right. So Oklahoma, Kansas, and Texas, there were hurricane-force winds. They created dust storms and wildfires. On Friday, 8 people died in a 71-vehicle pileup in Kansas. That was after a dust storm suddenly reduced visibility to near zero. That closed Interstate 70 for over 24 hours. Another 3 people were killed in a dust storm-related crashes in Amarillo in the Texas Panhandle. In Oklahoma, Governor Kevin Stitt said that high winds stoked more than 130 fires across the state, killing 4 and damaging or destroying nearly 400 homes. And in Texas on Sunday, officials say there's more than 42,000 acres were burning from 36 different wildfires, including a nearly 10,000-acre wildfire near Fredericksburg in central Texas. The threat of fires is expected to continue there into the next week.
Wow, so that's all of that's a lot. What does recovery look like?
So the process is really just starting. President Trump said on his Truth Social account yesterday that he's monitoring the storm damage and that he and First Lady Melania Trump are praying for everyone impacted. He promised to assist state and local officials in the recovery. And he said National Guard troops were already deployed to Arkansas, where the most powerful tornadoes took place. Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders surveyed damage there Saturday.
Our goal is to help and aid the local folks on the ground. Take care of people. We'll worry about the paperwork later.
This is just the beginning of tornado season, and more severe weather could be on its way in the next several weeks.
That's NPR's Ryland Barton. Ryland, thanks.
Thank you.
This was supposed to be a season of joy for 28-year-old Noor Abdullah. She and her husband were preparing for their first child next month. Then he was detained. Those preparations are on hold now as she fights for Mahmoud Khalil's release. The Palestinian Columbia graduate student and legal permanent resident who was taken by Homeland Security agents for his involvement in campus protests against Israel's war in Gaza. In between nonstop calls with lawyers and anxious friends and family, Noor took some time to talk to me about the struggle to get him back. I want to just start with how you're doing, what your days have been like since Mahmoud was taken.
It's been very overwhelming. It's like when I wake up in the morning, it's a lot of like, just go, 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 call after call after call. It really, I don't think it like hits me until like, sorry, I'm a mess this morning.
As an international student, Mahmoud took the risk of arrest, suspension, maybe even losing his student visa at the time, to be a public face of these protests on his college campus. For him, the cause was deeply personal.
Mahmoud is Palestinian. He was a Palestinian refugee in Syria. And then when things started happening in Syria, he was a refugee in Lebanon. So he has been the oppressed person, you know. He believes that, like, he doesn't only have a duty to liberate himself from the oppressor, but also to liberate the oppressors from their hatred and tyranny. And I think that's something he firmly believes in because of his personal experiences, but also because, like, he knows right from wrong.
Neither Noor nor Mahmoud really worried about his choice to protest. They believed they had a right to freely express themselves under the First Amendment. That was an assumption that fell apart the night of Saturday, March 8th, when a man in plain clothes followed them into their building.
He's like, "Are you Mahmoud Khalil?" Mahmoud said, "Yes." And he says, "I'm with the police. You have to come with us." I think at that point, like, honestly, like, my heart sank. I want to say, like, Mahmoud tried to prepare me because I feel like he had a feeling, but I don't know that I ever took him seriously.
In what way was he trying to prepare you?
Like, 2 days before, he told me, like, "Do you know your rights if ICE comes to your door?" And I, like, brushed it off. I was like, "What are you saying? Like, don't say that. That's not going to happen, you know?" But he was like, "No, like, you need to know." And he had emailed Columbia a day before, basically saying, like, "I have a feeling that ICE is going to come. I need you guys to intervene."
And he didn't get a response to that email, right?
He didn't get a response to that email, no.
And so at this point, your heart is sinking. What is happening in front of you?
Mahmoud is trying to ask the officer, like, "Who are you with?" He said, "Department of Homeland Security." And then he asked him, like, "Can I see a warrant?" He's like, "It's on my phone," but never really showed it to us. And the officer was like, "Give the keys to your wife," basically. And I was like, "I'm not leaving him." And the officer goes, "I'll arrest you too."
He said this even though Noor is a U.S. citizen.
Mahmoud gives me the keys and he says, "Go get my green card."
When Noor returned, 3 more immigration agents had surrounded him. One said Mahmoud's student visa was revoked, so Noor showed him her husband's green card.
And the agent looked very, very confused, and whoever was on the phone with him said, like, bring him in anyways.
You're going to be under arrest, so turn around.
This is audio from footage Noor filmed that night as agents placed Mahmoud in handcuffs.
Turn around.
Okay, he's not resisting. He's giving me his phone, okay?
He appears calm and polite. He looks to his wife to reassure her. She grabs his phone before he's taken away to talk to his immigration lawyer on the line.
Yeah, they just like handcuffed him and took him. I don't know what to do. And what should I do? I don't know.
Noor follows the agents outside as they lead Mahmoud into an unmarked car and she asks their names.
We don't give our names.
He's saying they don't give their names.
He'll be taken to immigration custody at 26 Federal Plaza.
Oh, and then they just drove away with him.
Were you terrified?
Very. I think that's probably the most terrifying thing that's ever happened to me.
For 38 hours, she didn't know where her husband was. And then he called.
So I answered and he's like, hi, how are you? How's the baby?
Aww.
And I'm like, yeah. I'm like, don't act so normal, please. But, you know, that's the type of person that he is. Even through all of that, like, he was trying to calm me down, you know?
Mahmoud is at a detention facility in Louisiana, and his case is being fought in court. It's captured the nation's attention. There are demonstrations and debates on whether free speech is in fact protected in this country, and if Khalil is paying the price for protesting.
No! We want justice, you say,
how? Release Mahmoud Khalil, now!
Where exactly are we in the poem that begins, when they came for the communists, I did not speak out? Well, they've already come for the asylum speakers. They've come for the migrant families. Now they've come for Mahmoud Khalil. It's not a very long poem. So how far down the list do you think you are?
The Trump administration claims that Mahmoud Khalil is a Hamas supporter, a designated terrorist organization in the U.S., while presenting no evidence of that accusation. Plus, the administration is not saying he's being deported for a crime, nor is he being charged with one. They're instead invoking a rarely used immigration provision that gives the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio in this case, the power to deport someone he deems could have, quote, serious adverse foreign policy consequences. President Trump has promised more student protesters will be detained and deported. I put these accusations to Noor.
I just want to be clear that the smears against Mahmoud are exactly that. They're smears. He has and always will stand up for what's right. And the way that he was taken from his family was not right.
How are you doing this? Are you preparing for the baby? Like, what do you think Mahmoud will be home?
Even before all of this happened, I would joke with him. I'm like, what if you're like traveling or something? Or what if I was visiting my family and then like you weren't able to like come for the birth? You know, that was so scary to me, for me to have to give birth by myself. And now we just don't really know if he is going to be there.
Let's say tomorrow this is resolved and Mahmoud is released and this case is dropped. Do you think you two would feel safe just going back to living here, the lives that you were living?
I don't know that I love this apartment. And I love the place that we live. And Mahmoud, like, we always talk about, like, I wish we could stay here forever, right? But I think, unfortunately, they kind of... they took away that sense of security and that sense of safety. And I don't know that that's something really you can fix after what happened.
Are you talking about the apartment or are you talking about the country?
I think both.
So you don't know if you would stay in the U.S.?
I can't, honestly, like, that's a hard question to answer.
Critics say maybe that's the point, that the fear of what's happening will be enough to silence speech the government doesn't agree with. That was Noor Abdallah, the wife of Mahmoud Khalil, a Columbia graduate student and lawful permanent resident the Trump administration is trying to deport. This is NPR News.
It's 19 minutes after 7 o'clock. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr with Chris Walker.
We receive support from the Green Heron Bed and Breakfast, a four-season B&B on Pacagama Lake, featuring home-cooked meals and all the amenities for a complete
family vacation. More information at greenheronbnb.com.
We also thank the First State Bank of Big Fork with branches in Big Fork and Collier, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com. Member FDIC. Weather today, we have a slight chance of snow, mostly cloudy, highs 40 to 49. East winds 5 to 10, mostly cloudy overnight, with lows 20 to 25. And tomorrow, mostly cloudy, highs near 40. Looking ahead to Wednesday, partly sunny with highs in the upper 30s and breezy north winds. It is time for Events Up North. It's a closer look at some of the events happening across northern Minnesota this week.
That's right. The Grand Rapids chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness has a webinar on gaming addiction this Thursday, March 20th at 6 p.m. Register at NAMI, N-A-M-I, GrandRapidsMN.org.
The Arrowhead Concert Association presents Paolo Chianchi at Hibbing High School Auditorium this Thursday, March 20th, 7 p.m. Chianchi will perform a variety of guitars with styles ranging from classical to rock.
The Rife Theater Arts in Grand Rapids presents Newsies Junior March 21st to 23rd. Find tickets and showtimes at rifecenter.org.
And the Sustainable Sheep and Fiber Community of Northern Minnesota has a gathering at the Clearwater Life Center in Gonvick this Friday from 1 to 3. You can learn some fiber art, or you can also share your latest projects. All are welcome.
And the Bemidji Public Library and Lake Bemidji State Park team up to present a recipe swap and discussion of the Good Berry Cookbook Saturday, March 22nd at 2 p.m. The State Park's artists in residence will assist in decorating recipes as well.
And there is a meatball dinner to benefit the Bagley Senior Center on Sunday, March 23rd from 11 to 2 at the Bagley American Legion. Live music by Figuring It Out follows at 2 p.m. and all proceeds will go toward a new roof for the Senior Center.
And the Heartland Symphony presents a concert Sunday, March 23rd at 2:30 at the Gitche Zibbe Center for the Arts in Brainerd. It will feature the world premiere of Ian T. Jones' film music, a piece inspired by the band Radiohead.
And finally, Great River Rescue has their annual Fur Bowl. That's this Sunday from 1 to 3 at Bemidji Bowl. Individuals and teams may register at greatriverrescue.com. We'll be learning more about that event and what else is happening with Great River Rescue with Executive Director Marina Lovell. That's coming up this morning, 8:45.
That's right. Any event with puppies, kittens, I am all for discussing. But I'm a little disappointed because I think last time we had a conversation with a local rescue, there were kittens brought in into the studio, and you informed me that there will be no puppies in the studio, right?
No, not today.
Yeah,
not
that's today. Okay. All the more reason to attend the event, right?
Yep. Events Up North is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota. If you have events to share with our listeners, you can email psa@kaxe.org and look for Events Up North at our website, kaxe.org, every week. We're going to listen now to our album of the week. We get to kick it off right now this morning, Chris. That's always very exciting.
That's right.
The album is called AOEIU, An Ordinary Exercise in Unity by Florence Aduni. Aduni is a Ghanaian gospel and high life singer making her international debut on this album. High life is a genre from Ghana that formed out of local rhythms with Western jazz melodies with horn and guitar leads over up-tempo rhythms. She sings in both English and Frafra, a language and people from the northeast prairies of Ghana. You can let us know what you think of our album of the week. Text in 218-326-1234. This song is called the Song. Summer Album of the Week. That is Florence Aduni. The song was called A Song from the album An Ordinary Exercise in Unity. What did you think?
That was a fun song. Fun way to start the morning.
Yeah, that'll get you going.
Pretty easy karaoke song, too. You can kind of get get more of the dance into it. And I like it. Easy sing-along.
Yep. Coming up shortly after 7:30, we're going to have Best Wishes. And if you have birthday or anniversary greetings to share, you can text in 218-326-1234. It is the Monday Morning Show. I'm Jennifer Barr with Chris Walker.
Good morning. Happy St. Patrick's Day, everyone. We want to thank Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital for their support of KEXE, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org.
We also thank Minnesota Power, an elite company envisioning a carbon-free future through their Energy Forward strategy. More at mnpower.com/energyforward. There's more ahead from Morning Edition.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Managing screen time for kids, one of the biggest issues that defines modern parenthood. Teenagers who often do not want to be managed present an extra set of challenges. Well, the American Psychological Association now has a new toolkit to help parents. And NPR's Katie Riddle is here to tell us all about it. Screens and teens, why is this so hard?
Well, you know, as I was reporting this, I started thinking of it like nutrition. You know, like we all broadly know what we need to do, avoid ultra-processed foods and sugar, eat plants, etc. And yet, for many of us, it's still an ongoing struggle. And for screens, you don't want your kid on too long. Anyone who's seen the internet knows there's some really concerning content that you don't want your kid seeing. Here's a mom I talked to named Lauren Salem. She has four kids spanning the tween and teenage years, so she's a real pro. And she was the first one to tell me she does not have all the answers.
There's a lot of big picture guidance, but really there's a disconnect between I get what I'm supposed to do, I get what we're supposed to be aware of, but how do we actually incorporate it in our life, in our family?
Parents are really yearning for guidance.
And that's what you're here for, loaded down with all the answers.
I wish, since I also have a couple of adolescents at home. To be clear, there's no panacea for handling this, but the researchers who worked on this new guide do have some helpful strategies for parents. Here's Mitch Prinstein. He's the APA's chief science officer.
We really want parents to feel like, rather than throw up their hands and feel like it's totally impossible to monitor everything, maybe to give them some tools so they have a sense of how they can talk with their kids about what they're watching.
That's one of the things that Prinstein and his colleagues keep coming back to. Talk with your kids about what they're watching. So, for example, influencers are big now. Lots of teens watch them. You can find an influencer on any subject, style, sports, makeup, romance novels. Some of them can be fun and harmless, but others can contain hostile language or negative social behaviors, even promote substance abuse or self-harm. Teens and tweens are really figuring out who they are, and they're especially susceptible to social messaging. So it's important to know with some specificity what your kids are watching.
Yeah, the problem is, though, I mean, you can't sit with your kid the entire time they're on a screen.
Right. I mean, how would you ever get dinner cooked?
Yeah.
Now, if your teen is looking at screens constantly, you can encourage them to take breaks. But the end goal is to help your child build critical thinking skills so that they are able to bring a more discerning lens to content. For example, one suggestion, have open-ended conversations about how advertising works on apps and digital platforms, including how ads are targeted based on viewing habits. Another example, teens really don't like to be manipulated. So help them to identify sponsored content, even when it's subtly integrated into videos. The most important thing is to stay engaged. Sometimes that might look like just saying, I don't know how much screen time you should be watching every day. What do you think? Or sharing with them the kind of things you're struggling with. Screens are not going away, so the more you can engage with them in a productive way, the better.
That's NPR's Katie Riddle. And now if you're interested in the toolkit, you can find a link to it at npr.org. Katie, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19. The CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of Z-Quil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZQuil.com.
This is NPR News.
This is the Monday Morning Show on KAXE 732. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Barr with Chris Walker.
Good morning, everyone. Looks like the sun is just trying to peek its way out. Hopefully it can make its way out a little bit through the clouds.
Yeah, I think it is. It's going to be mostly cloudy today. There is a slight chance of snow and highs today in the 40s, the lower end of the 40s in northwestern Minnesota, and then up to 49 in Brainerd. So that is our range with east winds 5 to 10. And then tonight, lows in the low 20s. And tomorrow, mostly cloudy, highs near 40.
Not too shabby.
No.
I think we'll take it.
Yeah. You can let us know if you got much snow over the weekend. We really didn't get much in the Grand Rapids area. But if you did, you can text us 218-326-1234. You can also answer our question of the week. Tell us about a time that luck was on your side.
Yeah, this one should be fun.
Yeah.
I'm excited to hear the answers roll in.
Yep. And then also for Headwaters this morning, DJ Dang wants to hear about your favorite things about the country of Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
Its culture, its people. Tell us if you've been there. You can text in. Again, number is 218-326-1234.
Have you been there, Jennifer?
I have not been to Ireland. I've been to England, but
okay,
not as far to Ireland.
Yeah.
You?
Yeah, I went once back in college, and we were only in Dublin for couple nights, so it was a pretty quick trip.
Yeah,
but I've been wanting to go back and explore the countryside, and a lot of other people I've talked to did the same thing. They didn't really stay in Dublin, and Dublin was great. We had a really fun time.
Yeah,
just fun. One of those cities you could just walk around. You don't need a map. Get lost in, and history everywhere, pubs, things to do. But the countryside, of course, everything I've seen looks incredible.
Yeah.
So.
Well, it is time for best wishes here on the morning show. We're going to do our best to wish friends and neighbors happy birthday, happy anniversary. We're going to start with yesterday, Sunday, March 16th, which we should acknowledge a happy belated St. Urho's Day to everybody.
Of course. Of course. That's right. I just learned about St. Urho's Day this year.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. Don't have really a Finnish background, but
no.
Yeah. Sounds like fun. So happy anniversary, Nancy and Nick Eltgroth. Out of Grand Rapids. Happy anniversary yesterday.
Happy 70th birthday yesterday to Gretchen Samala from the Deer River area. And
happy birthday, 68th birthday, Ellen Christmas in Grand Rapids.
And then today is March 17th. Happy 58th anniversary to Randy and Christine Rowan from Bovee.
Happy birthday to Patty Anderson today.
And Katie Schmidt, happy 43rd to you in Brainerd.
And last but not least, happy 73rd birthday to Mike Hansen up in Cook. I wonder if anyone's going to be doing green birthday cakes. They get the dual celebration, holiday and birthday, you know?
Yep. Well, we wish you all the best, and we're going to hear some music from the Irish band, the Cranberries. This one's called Dreams.
We'll be right back.
That is the Cranberries with Dreams. The album is called, I love this album title, Everybody else is doing it, so why can't we?
Exactly. Cranberries is essential part of any St. Patrick's Day playlist, I'd say. Mm-hmm. For sure.
It is the Monday Morning Show on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr with Chris Walker.
Support for KEXE comes from Headwaters Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bemidji, gathering at 10 a.m. on Sundays now through May at the Headwaters Peace Center. HUF is an inclusive space to seek truth, practice love, and celebrate life. Learn more at headwatersuu.org.
And we thank the Hibbing Chrysler Center serving northern Minnesota, carrying Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, and Ram vehicles with staff available to assist on the Beltline in Hibbing or at hibbingchrysler.us.
Well, we did best wishes a little bit ago, and we got one more in our text line, and we want to say happy birthday to Sandy Epp Ryan from White Bear Lake. Happy birthday, Sandy.
Yep, that is from your friend Kathleen in Brainerd. Phenology is the rhythmic biological nature of events as they relate to climate. It is time to hear from John Latimer with our Daily Dose.
On today's date, March 17th, 1992, the first Canada geese are seen returning to northern Minnesota. Typically, it's a flock or two that kind of slide into the area early and begin to honk and call from little ponds and potholes that might be open, little streams. They always seem to find the creek that runs out of the lake that I live on and settle in there and call and make a ruckus and establish their territories for another year of raising their young. Average date for this to happen is the 22nd of March. The latest I ever had record of it happening was the 12th of April in 1988, and the earliest I can recall it happening was on the 28th of February in the year 2000. They are anxious to get back and will probably be resting on area rivers and lakes wherever they can find open water. But the minute the water opens up on their natal lake, they're going to be moving back in there, get ready to raise another family.
That is our daily phenology. You can tune in tomorrow morning at 7:20 for John Latimer's latest observations. We'll also hear those student phenology reports starting at about 6:45. That's coming up on the Tuesday morning show. I'm Jennifer Barr with Chris Walker. Chris, have you been seeing any thing in nature of note?
I did this past weekend. We were at a friend's house. They live just a little bit south of Pacagama Lake in Grand Rapids, and can see the distance off in the distance, kind of where the lake is, and saw a group of swans, flock of swans flying overhead. And that was neat. And then, you know, I feel like every morning you hear a few more birds each and every morning, which is a fun sign. And I want to thank John Latimer for addressing my tick question last week, because we got a new dog this past winter and she's been going stir crazy with the warm weather. We've been letting her out a bit, and she loves to roam around our, you know, neighbors' yards. And so I'd reached out to John and asked him about, you know, when he's normally seen the earliest sign of ticks in the spring. And he addressed it on Tuesday's morning show last week and provided me a whole list of dates from the last 20 years of when the earliest signs of ticks are. So,
yeah, I saw that nice handwritten note with all those dates he gave you.
Any excuse to get some authentic John Latimer handwriting that I can hold on to and sell for lots of money later in life.
Yeah, a little known fact about John Latimer, great handwriting.
Incredible handwriting. I'm so envious.
Yeah, but I think people were seeing ticks last week.
Yeah, he did say he hadn't. I think he said he hadn't seen one yet, but he's sure that there's some out there already.
Yeah, I think Sarah Bignell said she saw some on her dogs, maybe.
Oh, yeah, I wonder, hers. And obviously deer ticks are the ones you need to worry about. And I think they come out earlier than wood ticks for the most part. But
yeah,
there you go. So
yeah, it doesn't take much.
No.
It can go, you know, first warm day, it's like, oh yeah, there's the ticks.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Well, last year too, I think I remember hearing, we didn't have a dog last summer, so I can't really speak to it. But the tick season was supposed to be really bad last year because of the warm winter. It didn't really get cold enough to kill off many of them. Mm-hmm. So I'd be curious to ask John or Sarah or anyone who has a dog if you want to text in at 218-326-1234 how tick season was for you last year.
Yeah.
Because I know it was supposed to be pretty bad.
Yeah, you can also answer our question of the week.
Yes.
This one might be a thinker. Tell us about a time luck was on your side.
I'm guessing that that won't really relate to ticks unless, you took a walk through a wooded forest and didn't come up with a single tick on you or your pet. Then that would be pretty lucky.
That's true. That's true. That does not relate to ticks at all.
Right, right. Yeah, we want to hear all about it. St. Patrick's Day, how luck was on your side.
Also, favorite things about Ireland that will be coming up during Headwaters with DJ Dang. He wants to hear all about it. He'll read your text at 10:30. That's coming up. And then 11 o'clock this morning, World Cafe. And at 1 o'clock, David John, your volunteer host for On the River. Right now, though, it is time for What We're Reading. It's our show all about books produced by our staff librarian, Tammy Bobrowski. Today we'll hear a conversation with Dennis E. Staples, a writer from Bemidji and a Red Lake Nation member. His new novel is set in northern Minnesota. It's a darkly humorous thriller about the ghosts that haunt casinos.
Dennis E. Staples is a writer from the Bemidji area and member of the Red Lake Nation. His debut novel, This Town Sleeps, was published in 2020, a thrilling story taking place in northern Minnesota, blending Ojibwe legends with the modern world, and featuring Marion Lafourniere, a mid-20s gay Ojibwe man whose family has ties to sacred power. Marion's story continues in Dennis's new novel, Passing Through a Prairie Country. In this story, fresh from a breakup with his boyfriend, Marion heads out of town for a break and stops at the hidden Atlantis Lake Resort and Casino, where he is reacquainted with his cousins Alana and Sherry and has an encounter with a dark force known as the Sandman. Dennis begins our What We're Reading conversation with what led him to becoming a writer.
I grew up in and around the Leech Lake Reservation area, Cass Lake in Bemidji. Went to school Cass Lake my whole life. I went to Bemidji State University for college, and I lived in Bemidji while I was doing my master's degree. I think the earliest I can remember thinking of myself as a writer, I was about in fifth grade, kind of making notes about different books I wanted to write. It was mostly just lists of chapter names that sounded cool to me, just basic story arcs. And then in sixth grade, one of my teachers recommended me for this program. It was like a writer's enthusiast kind of meeting. I think it might have been held in Thief River Falls. We met a few different northern Minnesota authors there. I remember meeting a writer named Mary Casanova, who does some children's books with a lot of animal themes. And that got me really excited and motivated to be a writer. But it was kind of on and off all through middle school and high school after that. And then it wasn't until about my second year of college, which would have been my first year at BSU, that I was thinking, you know, this is definitely the path and like the education direction I'm going to go in from here on.
This Town Sleeps was your first book published in 2020. That's where we were first introduced to your character, Marion Lafourniere, who is featured in your new book, Passing Through a Prairie Country. Can you tell us how this new book came about?
I did kind of scrap a previous idea that would go in a similar direction. It would go back into these families' past. I would build it out more and slowly move toward more like overt magical realism, supernaturalism genre. But in between signing the first book in about 2018 or so and mid-lockdown, I started having this other short story idea because I was reading a lot more horror then. And somewhere in all that, I pivoted to what the current novel became. And it was a lot less expansive as far as family trees and kind of solidified dynastic family tree stories and more of a modern, bit more compact, but friend of mine said ambitious, a much more ambitious modern kind of novel with a horror twist that I really thought I could deliver on.
The characters in Passing Through a Prairie Country, they each encounter a dark force at the Hidden Atlantis Lake Resort and Casino. What a great location for a haunting. This dark force is known in your story as the Sandman. What can you tell us about the Sandman?
I guess without getting a little too spoilery, the very beginnings of this presence in the book came from when I was in my undergrad years. I took a myth class that involved reading a lot of Ojibwe and Greek myths. So for Greeks, it was the classic plays, the Fury cycle, some early poems and all that. And then when we moved into the Ojibwe section, some of the books necessarily had to be a modern kind of scholar's compilation of tales. And I found a few different moments in this one book called Wisconsin Chippewa Myths and Tales by Victor Barno, where it describes some of the common tropes that were found in a lot of the stories. And some of them had to do with what would basically be like an anti-medicine man and an anti-shaman. It takes the shape of a malevolent old man figure who he kind of binds his will over his victims and kind of traps them in a bit of a distorted reality. I don't have better terminology for this, but like an anti-vision quest, a nightmare quest. What the book says about it is that their interpretation is that this comes from the Ojibwe not liking bossy people. And so the part of the psychology there is that that this figure who has like the trappings of a trusted advisor back then, that very much the opposite. They're not your spiritual guide. They are out to get you. They're out to own you, own your soul, all that. And from that trope, I started thinking about what would happen if that kind of presence is unleashed on a casino, because I had a lot of long hours working grave shifts at casinos. But I personally have never seen anything you could consider supernatural there. I heard a lot of, stories of guards, people late at night, either in the hotel, on the grounds, and, oh, what was that? I'm like, in order to get scared from these ghosts, I kind of got to make up some that I think will be a bit scarier.
So, yeah, the story is quite scary. It's also very evocative and atmospheric. You can really feel yourself in the casino with its flashing lights and electronic sounds. And there are scenes where the characters, and I think the readers too, don't always know if they can trust what's being presented to them, but this makes the story very thrilling. Can you talk about writing to that effect, where we can't always trust what we're seeing?
It's a hard thing to navigate, but I think that there's a few different authors that kind of helped me move toward that way. Thomas Ligotti, who does a lot of supernatural horror fiction, and John Cheever, a short story writer. He has a famous one called The Swimming Man. And these have this like really broken up narratives that will kind of present you scenes in almost montage fashion, but at the same time, you know, you're following this one thread. So the hallucinatory aspect kind of was informed by a lot of that, the like just the rush of not knowing who, where, what, you, all of that, but kind of going with it because you don't really know what else to do at that point.
I think it's always interesting to see how much a writer identifies with their characters. How much of your own story do you put into your books?
I try and split it up. So like Marion, he doesn't have any siblings. I have a lot of siblings. That was a conscious choice to try and make him a little different than me. But for all of them, I try and own in on something that I can sort of relate to. So like recently, I was asked about this for one of the characters, Glenn. He was kind of whole cloth. He's one of my characters that stole the show after like a very basic idea of what he would be. Mm-hmm. But a lot of his nerves and his confidence at like how he tackles this world. It was informed a bit about some of my, like, my more, like, the not easier parts of coming out and all of that. So some of Glenn's fears, I guess you could say, were informed there. With Alana, some of it was just overconfidence, I could say. Like, if you're just blindly running into a situation, some of that, I guess, I did with Alana. So it's just a matter of, like, kind of picking one emotional hotspot or emotional cue, and then just thinking about if I'd had similar circumstances here and there, and then just pushing the character that way, seeing what'll happen.
Dennis Staples' new novel is Passing Through a Prairie Country. It's What We're Reading. I'm Tammy Bobrowski.
And Dennis E. Staples will be talking about his new novel with writer Justin Hawley at Four Pines Bookstore tomorrow. That's Tuesday, March 18th at 6 p.m. We'll have a link to that information later this morning on our website, kaxc.org. What We're Reading is made possible in part by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.
It is 7:56. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show. I'm Jennifer Barr with Chris Walker. Coming up in the 8 o'clock hour, right before 9 o'clock, actually, we'll be talking with Marina Lovell from Great River Rescue. We'll find out about their Fur Bowl fundraiser this Sunday and what else is happening there at the animal shelter in Bemidji.
Yeah, a lot of great things happening there. Very, very excited for that conversation. Support for KEXE comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org.
We're going to hear some music now from Young Dubliners. They're doing a song called Fisherman's Blues. I know the Waterboys version better of this, but it's St. Patrick's Day, so we better hear from the Young Dubliners.
Exactly.